Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamani Sankhatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini.
Verse 34.
Sorry, which one?
34.
34?
34. Taddi pranipatena. Tad viddhi pratipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninastatvadarshinah tat viddhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninaha tattva darshinaha. In the previous verse, Bhagavan said, from all of the yajnas, you know, that all of the yajnas, all of which really involve dravyas, they all involve materials, things that you need to do that are going to create a result. From all of these yajnas, compared to all of these, jnana yajna is shreyas. There is nothing comparable to the jnana yajna, because the result that it gives is timeless. The result that it gives, the knowledge itself has nothing to do with dravyas, with things, with accomplishment, with karta, karma, the doer and the done. The jnana yajna has only to do with upadesha, the teaching between teacher and student of the Upanishad, of the teaching itself. And that teaching, that jnanam, removes the ajnanam, the ignorance, which is the cause for the lack of wholeness, the incompleteness, or the sense of bondage. And that pulla, the jnana pulla, the result of that knowledge is the recognition of your own self, which is free from time, free from space, changeless, immutable, something that you won't lose, which is so different from any other karma. All other karmas, not all other karmas, jnanam is not a karma, but all karmas give a result that is time-bound. Jnanam, removing the ignorance, just gives me back myself by through the recognition of myself, so that the gain is a gain of it's the achievement of the already achieved, and there is nothing greater than that achievement, because it's the achievement of myself, the removal of the jnanam, which is the recognition that I am the whole. So he says, then he says in the second line of that, he says, sarva karma, sarvam karma akilam, says, All karmas, all actions, in their entirety, without anything left over, everything is resolves into that jnanam. You know? And so then Shankara makes a bridge into this verse that we're doing today. He says, this vishishta karma, this most exalted, this jnanam, this most exalted knowledge, so he says, okay then. This knowledge is extremely special. This very special knowledge. How is it gained? By whom? In what way? In what manner? How? By whom is this knowledge achieved? You know, who gets this knowledge? How do you get this knowledge? Is the question. So he says, speaking to Arjuna, Tad Viddhi. May you know, viddhi is imperative, viddhi, from vid. May you know, tad, that jnanam, tadvidhi. May you know that jnana. First, pranipatena. Pranipatena means, actually it's a, when we say normally what pranipata means, it means falling down flat. It's called a dirga namaskara. The dirga means a long namaskara. Namaskara is, you know, when I do the salutations like that, but the dirga namaskara is when you'll see so often in India the brahmacharis and the sannyasis when they come to Swamiji, to their teacher, they lay down flat so that their hands are flat, their face is on the, there's actually a shloka for this, their head, their forehead is touching the ground, their chest is touching the ground, hips are touching the ground, the knees are touching the ground, the feet are touching the ground. It's called, it's a, there's a dirga namaskara, there's another name for it that I can't think of right now. And so that is a namaskara, it's a, my salutations, but also it's a type of, we could say surrender, but surrender needs to be, that word is loaded. If we bring that word into the West, it's kind of a loaded word. But it's where the student says to the teacher, the namaskara is one of, it's a surrender of the buddhi in this sense. I want to learn this knowledge from you. I am ready to learn this knowledge from you. Both are necessary. The shraddha, when they give the definition of shraddha, it's always to both the acharya and the upadesha. Upadesha means teaching, the acharya means the teacher. Because if the shraddha is not there toward either one, the pramana won't work. Because say you have shraddha in the upanishad. Shraddha means you have a faith, we can translate faith pending understanding. Not that I have, it's not blind faith, but it means that my mind is available to learn this, wants to learn this, is open to learn this. I have to have that toward the Upanishad. If I don't have it toward the teaching itself, then I can still come to listen to the classes, but before those classes, before those unfoldments will work for me, I have to resolve the doubts that are keeping it at a distance. Because otherwise my mind is looking at the, it is analyzing the teaching, whether the teaching that's coming to me should be listened to or not. You know, is it worthy of my listening or not? Is this the truth, what's being said to me, or is this some BS that's being said to me? And so that's what my mind is focused on. As opposed to my mind being open, which we call shraddha, which we call Ishwara Nugraha. Why should your mind be open to anything? It's open to some things and not to other things. So why is your mind available to listen to this teaching? It has nothing to do with whether with inquiry or lack of inquiry. There can be a limitless amount of inquiry. There's no restriction on inquiry or penetrating questions or resolving doubts. It's not that. That's not the problem. But is my mind available to engage freely, fully engaged in that particular teaching? That requires shraddha. So in the prostration like that to the teacher, one is an acknowledgement of shraddha in this teaching, and the other is toward the teacher, because you can have so much shraddha in the teaching, but not in the teacher. And that could be a very big problem. If you're coming to the teaching, which you have shraddha in, but the teacher who's teaching it, you don't have shraddha in, then you can't really learn that teaching, which you do have the shraddha in, from the teacher who you don't have shraddha in. Because the mind won't be open. The mind will be open to the teaching, but not to the teacher. So the two have to come together. And so when a student does those the pranams to the teacher, it's a twofold statement. I want to learn this teaching, and I want to learn this teaching from you. So it's the acharya and upadesha. That's why whenever they define shraddha, these two will come together. And so this pranipatena, so Krishna says here, tadvidhi, may you know this first by this shraddha, right? the prostration is just a physical symbol of what of your attitude, right? That allows you to listen. So that's the first. Pranipatena. Then pariprashnena. Prashna means question. Pariprashna means by questioning. Pari means from all sides, to circle something. So say you have a topic, a subject matter, pari, and you want to ask a question. Your question should come, should be directed all the way around. You should freely question. So pari prashnena, it gets you license to ask all of the questions that need to be asked. So what that means is every question that comes into your buddhi, right, as the topic is being unfolded, those questions are meant to be asked. So with Shraddha, by asking the questions, the relative questions that are appropriate for the unfoldment, whatever that unfoldment may be, by that, and sevaya, by service. So service is what? It's so easy to talk about all of these things, including the namaskar and pranams and seva, all of these things, within an Indian context, because in India it's kind of like breathing, right? The teacher in India, so the students will take care of everything. You know, all of the meals, you know, taking care of the home, taking care of the ashram, doing whatever needs to be done. All of that work is done by the students. Bringing the tea, it goes on and on and on. Every doing the laundry. I mean, there isn't anything that isn't done, and then all of the students engage in that type of seva, transcribing books, all of the things that we all do. That seva is just part of being related to the teacher, and it's a very natural thing. It's another way of, to kind of demystify it. It's when you're coming as a child and you're living in the home, then you participate, you know, in all of the chores and all of the things that your parents have you do, right? That's not quite right.
No, it's not.
It's not quite right because there's a different kind of an attitude. But it's a participation. It's a participation. And that also shows a certain type of buddhi. Because another thing, it traditionally, and this is Swamiji has maintained this tradition, and I think that for the most part, the students maintain this tradition. They don't charge for this knowledge. You know, the knowledge is something that's meant to be. It's like the birthright of a mumukshu. If you're a mumukshu, then this knowledge is something that's there for you. It's not something that you, that within the tradition that you would be charged for. And so the teacher, in fact, takes care of all of that. And then the students, you know, are just now traditionally, and actually this is how it was for us too when I was in the 70s when I was there in India. There was no charge for anything. I was there at the ashram for 3 years. One stretch was 3 years. There was no charge at all, not for staying there, not for in eating there, not for the classes. There was zero charge. In fact, Swamiji used to give some of us money when we because we didn't have enough money. They took care of absolutely everything. And then when the student is done, released, they go on their own, then they give back. Then they give. That's the dakshina, that guru dakshina. So we always give back to the teacher. But the teacher doesn't charge, right? And so we give back in whatever ways we can give back. And that also is part of the seva. When you're with the teacher and you're learning, then you give what you can. And when you're away, you continue to give. That's all seva. It's what we call guru dakshina, you know? Guru Dakshina is what you give. What the thing is in India, the teacher doesn't charge, but the students give. you know? And so that's there in the buddhi. You know, maybe in the West it's not quite that way, and so maybe teachers feel that they have to charge because it's not in the culture. But even here in this country, Swamiji is not charged. But all he'll do at the ashram is charge room and board for the to help for the feeding and all. But in terms of for the teaching, no, he won't charge. So it's a certain mindset, and it's also speaks to the sanctity of this knowledge. So now what Shankara says, it's really interesting. In his commentary, he goes like this. He says, Acharyan Abhigamya. He says, having approached the teachers, Pranipatena, and then by the Pranipatena, he says, Dirga Namaskaraha. That means the full prostration. Approaching the teacher, then having with a full prostration, then there are the questions will come. Pariprashnena. Katam bandaha. What is bondage? Katam mokshaha. You know? Katam. How is there bondage? Katam mokshaha. How is liberation? How does that take place? Ka vidya. What is avidya? What is ignorance? What is vidya? What is knowledge? Ka avidya and ka cha avidya. And what is ignorance? He says, by all of these questions. And then he says, by guru seva. Shushrusha is this same thing, seva. It's just serving the teacher. Then what does he say? This is what I thought was interesting. Those teachers, being pleased, being attracted to you by your behavior, he says, Prashrayena avarjita acharyaha. He says, those teachers that are attracted or open to you, feel positive to you because of your attitude, by your attitude, by your behavior, upadekshanti, they will teach you. Those teachers will, because of your attitude, because of your wanting to learn, because of your respect for them, you wanting to learn from them, you know, and by having that proper attitude, then they will teach Tejnan, they will teach this Jnanam to you. Okay, that's what he says. So he says, Upadekshanti Tejnanam. They will teach this knowledge to you. Who will? Jnaninaha. Those who have knowledge themselves. The Jnaninaha means those who know. Those people who know, they will teach this knowledge to you. But it's not just knowing. He doesn't stop there with this jnaninaha. It's not just about those who know, because they could just be a pundit, somebody who's very familiar with the Vedas and with the Upanishads, and the student comes and says, please teach me, and the pundit can say, well, this is what the Upanishads say. And this is what they say. And they can tell you accurately what the Upanishads say. And this is what Shankara says, this because they can read Sanskrit. And they're familiar with what the Upanishads say, but they're familiar in third person. Mm. Right? So you can be a jnani in the sense that you're familiar with material, you know the material, you're a pundit, you're a scholar with that material. And so the student will say, please teach me. And the teacher will teach. Yes, this Upanishad says this and this and this. This is how Shankara comments on these verses, and this is how this is the Purvapaksha Siddhanta. These are the arguments that come and teach you. But it's in a third-person way. So instead of just saying, jnaninaha, those who know, they will teach you if you approach in this way. He says, not just jnaninaha, tatvadarshinaha. Those jnanis, the people who know, who themselves see the truth. Tatva is the truth. Darshinaha means those who see it. They know it, they also see it. In fact, they are it. Because if you see it, that seeing means that you recognize yourself, you are what you see. In fact, the jnani is only teaching about yourself. Mm. Right? Because the atma that they're talking about is the atma, is the self that you are. The Brahman they're talking about is the Brahman that you are. The Ishwar that they're talking about is the Ishwar that you are. So the jnani, who is a Tattva Darshinaha. Darshina means one who is seen. So Tattva Darshinaha, the one that Jnani, who is a Tattva Darshinaha, those people, they will teach you. They will teach you because of the way you have approached. Now, what Shankara says here, he talks about this. He says, Jnanavantaha api, even though having knowledge, being one who has knowledge, Jnanavantaha api, kechit yatavat tattva darshana shilaha. He says, some of those people who have knowledge, they are ones for whom that knowledge of the truth is shila. It's absolutely natural. They see it. That seeing of the truth is just their own svabhava. It's their own nature. Right? They're people who have nishta in that seeing. So there's those people who see it as it is. They are that. Then he says, apare na. But there are others who are not that way. That apare means others, no. Some are abiding it. They have jnana nishta. They see the truth and they are that which they see. That's all in the shila. The others, no. Ektaha, therefore, vishinashti tetradarshinaha iti. Therefore, he qualifies it with this tetradarshinaha. And then he says, ye samyak darshinaha. It's those who have samyak, are samyak darshis. I mean, their vision is samyak. It is clear. They have clarity. They have clarity of vision. So those who have clarity of vision, taihi by them, upadishtam jnanam, this knowledge which is taught by them is karyakshamam. It gives the proper result. Karya means result. Karyakshamam means it gives the proper result. It is appropriate. Not itarat, not the other. It's very powerful what he says. And because this knowledge is that is being given to the student is knowledge about your own being, it has to be taught to you by somebody who knows that. Because if that aparoksha jnanam, if that direct immediate knowledge isn't there, if that tetra darshinaha, that actual seeing of my being, if that isn't there, then what is the student, what is the teacher teaching? What is the teacher teaching? So Swamiji said about this is that the words themselves of the Upanishads, of the Bhagavad Gita, of all of these texts, they themselves can inspire and do inspire. You know, and put the student on the right track. But then these Upanishads, including the Bhagavad Gita, which is considered as a Upanishad, and that's not one, but it's treated as an Upanishad. These Upanishads need to be unfolded. They have there's a sampradaya, there's a methodology to unfolding them, right? And so that methodology, the teacher themselves, herself or himself, has had to go through and has had to recognize, I am that. And the Mahavakya is aham brahmasmi. I am Brahman. Teaching is not saying, the Mahavakya says, I am Brahman. That's not the teaching, right? That's third person teaching. But the teacher has to be able to say, I am Brahman, and then unfold according to the prakriyas, according to the sampradaya, the truth of that step by step by step, so that the student can also say, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. But how can that happen for the student through the teaching of a teacher for whom that hasn't happened? So that becomes very risky, very iffy, very iffy. So, in the Mundaka Upanishad, there's that famous verse that for the student who has become a mumukshu, who has recognized the anityatvam of all of the karmapalas, and recognized that karmapala can't give me anything lasting, that that student should approach a teacher, Guru Meva Bhigachet, should a guru with sticks in hand, right? Should put sticks in hands because that stands for seva. Should approach it as a very traditional way of doing it. Should approach the teacher with sticks in hand, right? A teacher who is Kshatriya, and Brahmanishtam. Kshatriya means a person who is learned in the Shruti, who knows the Sampradaya, who themselves has been exposed to the Sampradaya, the teaching methodology, the teaching tradition. But not just a Kshatriya who is a Brahmanishtha, who themselves is a Tattvadarshinaha. Themselves are Tattvadarshinaha. Means they are ones who actually see, who actually have aparokshagnam, direct immediate knowledge of this. Then that person can teach. You know, Paramarthananda, who is one of Swamiji's well-known, Swami Paramarthananda, very well-known, a disciple of Swamiji who's teaching in Madras. He was a Vedic, he studied the Vedas as a young boy growing up, came in a Brahmana family, and he had learned all of the Vedas, and he was just brought up in a very, very traditional home. So he was a young boy, must have been, I think he was 16, when Swamiji was starting the second course. Swamiji was interviewing potential students that he would be accepting for this course, and he was in Madras at that time, not Chennai, but he was in Madras at that time. And Hari, which was his name then, Paramarthananda, came to Swamiji with these samitpanihi, these are special sticks that are used, you know. So he came with a whole bundle of these sticks and then gave them to Swamiji and did the full namaskara, you know, and then did some special chants saying, please accept me as a teacher, and please accept me as your sishya, as your student, you know. That was a very, very nice, because he was totally brought up in that tradition, you know. So that samit panihi, that the samit, you know, say in the ashram when we were in Rishikesh, staying for some time at Swamiji's ashram, there wasn't any stoves or electricity or anything. So everything was done with fire and candles and that type of thing. And so lighting the fire, preparing the fire, the cooking fire, the fire, the bonfire outside that we would all sit around, that type of thing. You know, that was all done by the brahmacharis, right? So that's what this summit is, these sticks, this particular type of stick that are used for the fire, that are used for rituals, that are used for all of that. So it just has become a symbol. So when a brahmachari in India approaches the teacher, if they're traditionally brought up themselves, they'll approach with these samit panihi, means hands. So samit panihi, with these samit, you know, twigs in their hands, they'll approach the teacher, and then they'll do the full namaskara, which is what is being talked about here. So actually these words, like this pranipatena, the full namaskara, the full prostration, and the seva, and all of these things, these are things that are so traditional, so very well known in India. So when you're in India, all of this is so alive and so real. When we are teaching about that here, we don't have the culture that includes all of that type of ritual and behavior and attitude, that we can appreciate it. We can appreciate it here. But when you're in India, even as a Westerner, when you're in India, you more than appreciate it. It all just makes sense because it's all part and parcel of the culture. So Shankara in his Abhasha, he says, so that those jnanis, may you know this by approaching the teacher properly. You know, approach the teacher properly, and they will be pleased with you. And being pleased with you, they will be happy to teach you. They're pleased with you because they see you as a mumukshu who sincerely wants to learn from them. And if they feel that from you, that you are mumukshu, and you seriously want to learn from them, then they will be so happy to teach you. And who are they, those people? Who should they be that are happy to teach you? There should be a jnani who knows this, has this knowledge themselves. Okay, so let's go to the next one.
Yajñātvā na punarmoham evam yāsyasi pāndava evam yāsyasi pāndava yena bhūtānya śeṣena yena bhūtānya śeṣena drakṣasyātman yathomayi drakṣasyātman yathomayi yet jñātvā na punaha moham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutani asheshena drakshasi atmani ataha mayi.
And so Shankara says, and when this is so, and when it's like this, the student approaches the teacher and the properly, and the teacher then will teach. When it's like this, then this also is what will happen. So he says, yet jñātvā, he Pandava, son of Pandu, Arjuna, hey Arjuna, having known which, na punar, not again, not again, moham evam yasyasi. You will not again go to this type of delusion. You won't become deluded again in this manner, the delusion that you're suffering from now. That won't happen again. Alright, so having known this, the type of delusion that you're suffering from now, that won't happen again. That knowledge, yena, by which you drakshasi, you will see bhutani asheshena, beings, all beings without any leftover. Ashesha means a remainder. Ashesha means without any remainder. So, by which bhutani, beings, all living beings, all beings, without any leftover, you will see atmani in yourself. You will see all beings in yourself, atmani, ataha, and also mayi, in me. Krishna is talking from the standpoint of Ishvara. That knowledge by which you will see all beings without remainder as abiding in yourself and in me. So yes, the whole vision, really, because it's both atma and Ishvara. Right? So he says, this delusion that you suffer from now, having known that knowledge, that jnanam, the atma jnanam, having known that, this delusion, that this moha means delusion, confusion, that you're suffering from now, that will never come back again. What is that delusion? It's the delusion that is the dehatma buddhi, my being is this body, mind, sense organs, and jagat satyam. This world is real. This world is real, and I'm an individual within it. That's samsara, right? By this world is real means it is the existent reality. And we say, you have to understand what we mean when we say this world is real. It means this world that we are experiencing through our sense organs, this is the reality. This is satyam. This is the truth, this, that we experience. And I am this body, living in this world. That's dehatma buddhi, that conviction, the buddhi, the knowledge, right? The conviction. It's mitya jnanam, it's an erroneous knowledge, but it's the conviction that this deha, deha means sukshma sharira and stula sharira, this whole upadhi here, this upadhi is this physical body. Here I am. The atma is this, dehatma buddhi. And this world is the reality. The best way to say it when I say jagat satyam, this world is the reality. That mityatva buddhi is not there. For the mityatva buddhi to say jagan mitya, I have to be able to recognize that there is something which is the substrate being of this. Like in order for the, for instance, for the rope snake, to have a mityatva buddhi of the snake, I have to know the rope. There's no mityatva, right? There's no dependent reality for the snake without knowing the rope, right? And so there's nothing I can do about that snake. I can't get rid of it. Snake remains a snake until I know the rope. And then the snake becomes mitya. Okay? It's the same here. I can't do anything to get rid of the jagat satyam, the reality of this world, right? Until I know what is the adhishtana. What is, when we say the adhishtana, what we're talking about there, what is the truth of the mitya? What is it because of which the mitya can be? And that's the adhishtana. Like, what is it that allows the snake to be? What is the truth of the snake? What is there that allows the snake to be? That's the adhishtana. Right? So there would be the rope in reference to the snake. Without the rope, the snake cannot be. So the adhishtana of the snake is the rope. Right? What is it that would allow this to be mitya? That has to be known. Without that, this world is real and I'm a jiva within it. So that is the moha. That is the delusion, the confusion that is brought about, that is an effect of ajnanam, of the adhishtana, of the satyam. If I don't know the truth, right? If I don't know the truth, what is the adhishtana, then this becomes the reality. It's the same like rope snake, see? And so in order for the jagad mitya, for this world jagad mitya, for the world to become mitya, I need to know the satyam. And who is going to be, what is going to be the satyam? Is myself. But how can myself, how can the atma be the satyam, be the reality? If there's dehatma buddhi. Because if there's dehatma buddhi, if the deha, if the body is taken to be the self, this body itself is part of the jagat, is part of the creation. Right? This body, mind, sense organs exist within duality. Right? The mind exists within duality, the sense organs exist within duality, the physical body exists within duality. This body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of the jagat, of the world. Right? And so, for me, there can be no satyam apart from the jagat, as long as that jagat means creation, the world. As long as that dehatma buddhi is there. Because the deha, the body, belongs to the jagat. And so the jagat is real and I am real. The jagat is real and I, this body, mind, sense organs, am the reality. And that is it. In order to be liberated from that, for the Atma to be liberated for that and for, from that, and for the jagat satyam to become jagat mitya, right? For the world, instead of being taken as real, to be understood as mitya, the adhishtana has to be liberated from the creation. The viveka, that is the viveka. That's the discrimination. I need to be able to differentiate the satyam from the mitya. If I can't differentiate the satyam from the mitya, then the mitya becomes satyam. That means, if the mitya becomes satyam, if this world becomes satyam, then what is the truth about me is that I'm subject to birth and death, I am a samsari. I'm subject to change, I'm subject to birth and death, and that is everybody's plight. And so what is Shankara, what is Krishna telling Arjuna? Having known this, this delusion, having known this, gained this knowledge, this moha, this delusion cannot come again. Just like if once I know the rope, I can't get that snake back. You can talk about it how it used to be, but you can't get a real snake back. You can't create it again. Once I know myself, I can't get this dehatma buddhi back. I can't get the jagat satyam back. Because I've recognized the truth, the adhishtana. See, that's the thing. Once the adhishtana, what the substance of what is actually there, once that is seen, means aparoksha jnanam, once I've recognized, then the satyam is liberated from the mithya. In fact, you realize, and when we think about satyam mithya, the mithya has no substance apart from the satyam. The snake has no substance apart from the rope, and this creation has no substance apart from me. But for me to be able to see that, this dehatma buddhi has to be broken. The deha has to go be given over to the jagat. I have to recognize the whole, everything that exists within duality as being the jagat. And when I recognize that everything that exists within duality is the jagat, includes this body, mind, sense organs, then the atma is released, right, from the body, mind, sense organs. Right? Because the body, mind, sense organs are objectifiable. They belong to the jagat. Just like the jagat, the world is something perceived by my five sense organs. The body is perceived by my five sense organs. The mind is, the sense organs are perceived by the mind. The mind is perceived by the sakshi. It's illumined by awareness. And so all of these upadis are released into the jagat. And then what happens to the atma? The atma is released into its own swarupa. The atma is as though released into its own swarupa. How is it released? Because it was never bound in the first place. It's released by the elimination of ajnanam, by the removal of ignorance. But now, once your being, once you recognize that yourself is free, is something which is the adhishtana of all of this, then this jagat is no longer just jagat. This jagat is Ishwara. The jagat is recognized as Ishwara. Why? Why does the jagat, the world, become Ishwara? Because the adhishtana of the jagat is consciousness. The adhishtana of the jagat is me. If consciousness is the adhishtana, is the being of the jagat, then the jagat is a purusha. That's why we say purusha. The jagat is purusha, is a person. Because just like I take myself to be a person, I am a person. As a jiva, I'll say I am a person. The personhood that I'm superimposing on the jiva is the personhood which is Ishwara. It's the personhood which is Brahman. The Purusha is Brahman, which is the Atma. And so this Purusha, this personhood, which is the Atma, is the personhood of the jagat. Because what the upadi, the body, mind, sense organs, ahankara, everything that exists within duality is this jiva, is part and parcel of Ishwara, and Ishwara enjoys my being as its adhishtana. So Brahma Satyam, Jagan Mitya. I am the self of this creation, therefore this creation has a self. I am the conscious being and the adhishtana of this creation, which means this creation is a conscious being. The Nama Rupa, the names and forms of the creation, right? This Nama Rupa are all Mitya, right? Because they have no being apart from the adhishtana. So once a person sees that, when a person sees that, you can't go back. There's no going back. So that's why you can't become a jiva again. Because the jivatvam belongs to the upadi. Right? Jivatvam is the limited upadi. The limited upadi belongs to Ishwara. Right? The Atma is not a jiva. And yet, the jiva is the Atma, but the Atma is not a jiva. The jiva, the body is the Atma is not the body. The mind is the Atma is not the mind. That is satyam mitya. And so Krishna says, first he says in the previous verse, may you know this, know this. How to know it? Go to a teacher with the proper attitude. Teacher who knows, and that teacher will teach you. Teacher will be happy. They will teach you. Go to the proper teacher. Go with proper attitude. That teacher will teach them. Then, and having known that, once you've gone, they teach you. Then, knowing that, all of these problems, hey Arjuna, all of these problems that you're suffering from, these fears and delusions, all of these concerns that you have, all of these things will be gone and they won't come back. In fact, you will see this whole creation, all beings, as existing in yourself and as existing in me. All existing, it's just so beautiful. All existing in the Atma means all, that everything that you experience has its basis in your being, the Adhishtana, the Atma, and also in me. Two ways you can take this. I am Brahman, the Atma is Brahman, the Atma is me, Krishna is talking as Ishvara, and this infinite upadhi, this Maya upadhi, this jagat, this whole nama rupa, this whole name and form, this whole creation, all that we experience here is part and parcel of this infinite upadhi, this infinite creation, and this infinite creation has me for its adhishtana, has me for its being. I am its truth. So all these beings exist in you, and all of these beings exist in me. You can say from the Ishvara, so think of it like this, from the jiva upadhi, right, I recognize as a jiva, in this jiva upadhi, in my experience right now, everything that I experience has my being for its self. I am itself. Because without the dehatma buddhi, this body, mind, sense, organs belongs to the experience that you're having, right? As much as you experience the room, you just have to put your body, put your own upadhi in the room, and then the whole room is part of your experience, and the whole experience takes place in your being. You are the satchit, you are the conscious being which illumines this experience. You are the self of the whole experience. Let the body be in the room. And that self is the self of the whole. Right? So, all this exists in me, and all of this also is part and parcel of Ishvara, whose self is my being. So he says, knowing that, right, you will never again in this manner have these problems, these delusions. Right? By this knowledge, all beings without exception, you will see in yourself as well as in me. Very, very beautiful verse. Okay, let's stop here. Purnamidah, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamidachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva, Vasishyate, Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha, Harihi Om. Oops.
Can we just keep the light off?
About the Dehatma Buddhi.
The
Dehatma Buddhi.
Yeah.
Is that a part of his jacket as well?
Well, tell me a little bit more so I can see where you're coming from.
I understand. Is that something that when you put everything in the room and you see everything belongs to Ishvara, or everything is in your consciousness?
Yeah.
Does that include the belief that you are a separate?
Yes, even in the sense, say you have any vritti, any thought, whether it's ajnanam-based or jnanam-based, that's going to belong to the antakarna, to the mind, right?
Yeah.
And the mind exists within duality. Right. All of it does. It all belongs to Ishvara. But now, the thing is, when knowledge takes place, we can say bondage, moksha, even the teacher and the student, all are part of Ishvara. They all exist within the creation, exist within duality. But yourself, the Atma, is the Adhishtana. Means it doesn't belong to duality, it's the very self of the whole. And it's self-evident. So this teaching makes the mind, points the mind, makes it recognize to differentiate the Adhishtana, the self, from the changing thoughts. Even, for instance, say if I have a jnana vritti, I am Brahman, aham brahmasmi. That's a vritti. That exists within duality. And what if I say aham samsari, I am a samsari. That's a vritti. That exists within duality. One is knowledge, one is ignorance. The jnana vritti, the vritti part, even though it's a jnana vritti, knowledge thought, it still belongs to the antakarana, but the subject, what we call the vishaya, what the thought is pointing to, is the atma, which is free from samsara, is the adhishtana. Like say if I have a thought, this is a lamp, right? I have a vritti of this lamp. So the vritti, the objectification of the lamp and the labeling, this is a lamp, that belongs to my antakarana, to my mind. But this is free of the thought. In other words, this lamp exists whether I have the thought or not, whether I have the perception of it or not. Doesn't make, it's independent of it. So, but nevertheless, this is still in samsara. It's still in duality. And if I were to analyze this lamp and take it apart, I'd realize we can't even find the lamp because it's, you know, it's just a nama, it's just a name that can be dissected into smaller and smaller names. Like I could now have a pole and a base and a wires, you know. So this has no real reality. But just in terms of this example, if I have a thought modification of this, this doesn't depend on my thought modification. Now, here, in terms of self-knowledge, consciousness, the conscious being, which is the self, which is the Atma, this consciousness doesn't depend on the vritti. In other words, the conscious being that I am illumines whatever vritti is there. If I'm exposed to a teaching, the Upanishad, which makes this mind recognize and differentiate the mithya, means the changing thoughts and its own nature, from to differentiate it from the conscious being, which is stable, this mind is now recognizing itself as nitya and recognizing the satyam, which is its truth, as being independent of it. Now, why can that happen? It's because the self, the conscious being, is consciousness. It is its own experience. In other words, when you say me, I am, these are words. I am, I exist, I am a conscious being. These are all mithya, they're all words. They come and go. But the words are labeling something which is free of the words. And something which is itself self-evident and independent. Like when we say, awareness is self-evident. What that means is that I don't require the mind for the awareness experience to be. The me, sometimes I call it the me experience. What makes me me? Because that's a self-evident experience, this I am. You don't need the words I am or I am a conscious being in order to be. Right? You don't need those words. Consciousness itself is its own experience. So in fact, I could get rid of the mind and consciousness is there. You bring the mind back and then the conscious being is there and the mind says, I am the conscious being. Okay? But if I were to take the mind away, the conscious being is still there. But because of ignorance, the mind says, I am the conscious being. And so knowledge has to come in that makes the mind realize, well, wait a minute. Actually, even these words that I'm speaking right now are objectifiable. They come into being and they go out of being. Like everything, all thought itself is objectifiable that comes into being and goes out of being. Being itself, conscious being itself, never wavers in any way. And so the teaching makes you differentiate your being, which is absolutely self-evident and changeless, from the mind which has mistakenly taken itself to be it. That's what we call viveka. And then once that differentiation is recognized, then I can see that actually this body, mind, sense organs, everything I had taken to be the conscious being, actually is an object, belongs to Ishvara. It's actually part of the creation. Just like if you dream, all the dream characters are part of the dream. In this creation, all of the living beings and all things are part of the creation. Right? But the Atma, the self, is not. The self is not something that is objectifiable. It's not something that comes and goes or changes. And so that differentiation has to be made. When the differentiation is made, then the Atma becomes the Satyam because it doesn't change. Right? And everything else becomes Mithya because it's never away from the self, and yet it comes and goes into being and out of being. It's subject to change. So we never experience anything away from the Atma. The Atma is the Adhishtana. It's the very being of all of our experience. But the thing is that the being that I am doesn't waver, and everything else does. What is Mithya? Wavers. Wavers means it changes. It's objectifiable and it changes. Satyam doesn't change. Consciousness being doesn't change. So I have to differentiate between being and name and form, basically. Does that help?
I think so. I think. Can I ask you another question? Just tell me if it's repeating the same question. The actual misidentification of who I am, because that in some way, in a case like me, that seems very constant.
It is constant. You know why? Because the self is constant and the mind is always labeling the self. I mean, there is the, if we were to line up all of the different thoughts we have, which occurs the most? It's the I thought. Because the self is always there, and so the self is the locus, right? It's the centerpiece. Your being is the centerpiece of all your experience. So the ahankara, which is that misidentification, this I notion, is going to be coming all of the time, repeating itself all of the time.
What is this I thought that you're just winging? I thought.
I am my mind. I am happy. I am agitated. I am this body. I am a woman. I have such and such an age. I have brown hair. You know, I am awake. I am tired. All of these identifications, taking the Atma, the self, to be this body. So that's the ahankara, these misidentifications. Now, when you have knowledge, see, the thing is, the self is there all the time. It's timeless. And so the ahankara is going to be there as the label of that self. Right? Because the self is always there. So the label will always be there. Another question is the label born of ignorance or knowledge? if the label is born of ignorance, it's still going to be labeling the self, but then taking it, that adding a lot of baggage onto it. Like, I am perfect. Okay? I am a conscious being, perfect. But I am a conscious being who is this body problem. That's where the, what we call this knot of the heart comes in, Hridaya Granthihi, where the self is kind of lassoed by my ignorance to the body or the mind or the sense organs. Now, say knowledge takes place, and I used to all have the I am vritti, but the subject of the vritti is the atma now, not the body. Not the if the locus of the atma is the body, it's not just the body, it's the atma plus the body. Right? I am a conscious being who is this body, rather than I am the conscious being who is Ishwara. I am the jiva or I am Ishwara. If I say I am the jiva, then the aham is identified with this. If I say I am Ishwara, then the aham is limitless. The atma is limitless. And this whole infinite creation becomes my expression.
And in either case, the aham is really the same.
The aham is always the same. There's only one. The aham is just a word, but the subject of the word is atma, is always the same. Whether it be, if I say, I am a samsari, I am the body, I am Ishwara, I am Brahman, the I am is always only referring to the self, which is Brahman. But whether I say I am the body, the I am is still referring to the self, but there's some ajnana mixed in there, so it's taking that self that's referring to as me to be existing because of the body. See, if I say, I am the body, I am taking my being to be like a epiphenomena or a product of this body, because this body is I am. So therefore, I am the body. When the body dies, I won't be anymore. But the I am I'm referring to is really Brahman. It is the self of the body, you know, the Atma is the self of the body, but it's not dependent on the body. The body depends on the Atma for its being, but the Atma doesn't depend on the body. Like the snake depends on the rope for its being, but the rope doesn't depend on the snake. So I am the self of this body, but I am free of the body. And that's what, I am the self of this mind, but I am free of the mind.
There's a, you know, for the Dehatma Buddha, it's kind of a different order than the Deha, for example, or than most of Nietzsche, because, isn't it? I mean, because it's actually like the horn of a rabbit or something, right? It's completely. The idea that I am the body is. Isn't that a completely erroneous? Isn't there kind of a distinction between that kind of completely erroneous idea that's based on a complete error of perception and understanding versus the rest of Nietzsche, such as the lamp?
Oh, I think I know what you mean. Yeah, I think what you're trying to say there is there what we have called Vyavaharika Satyam means this whole creation. Everything in it on every level, subtle and gross, right, is Ishwara, and it enjoys an objective reality. Even my mind enjoys an objective reality because it exists, right? In Vyavahara, in samsara, in this creation, it exists, the body exists, the rug exists. All of these things have an empirical, shared reality that we can all talk about, okay? So, now, there's a subjective reality also. And that subjective reality has to do with how, like for instance, my projection of a snake on a rope or my imagination, things that aren't shared reality. So my ajnanam, my self-ignorance, is subjective in this sense that I can remove that self-ignorance. The fact that the self-ignorance is there is all part of Ishwara, right? Because there's ajnanam. From the standpoint of Brahman, there's just Satchitananda. Ajnanam can come to an end.
So this is the part that I don't really get to when you say that Dehatmabuddhi is part of Ishvara. I understand that the lamp is part of Ishvara, or the body is part of Ishvara.
Oh, it's only because of this.
In what sense is the something that's like the horn of a rabbit that doesn't even exist at all?
No, but we don't say that it doesn't exist. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I didn't follow before.
Yeah, okay.
Ajnanam, we don't say is non-existent. Mm-hmm. Ajnanam for us is positive. And it can be removed. But if you say that it's non-existent, then that's like what you're saying kind of then is your self-knowledge is not existent. Now, tell me again. What did you say? The jiva is non-existent.
No.
What do you say?
No, like the jiva in the sense of there being a body and a mind.
No, wait. You would say the jiva is Atma,
mm-hmm.
right? The truth of the jiva
right.
is Atma.
Yeah.
What makes the jiva a jiva is ajnanam, the Atma self-ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what allows for the jivatvam. How does that project? What does that ignorance cause? Ahankara. Right? That's the moha, that's the delusion that comes out of that ignorance. What ignorance is it? Self-ignorance. And the self-ignorance is there, then that delusion is there. But the delusion that that creates a jiva out of the Atma.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the jiva is the Atma. There is no jiva.
Right.
Or a better way of saying, if you say there is no jiva, you would say, a better way of saying that maybe, is that the truth of the jiva is the Atma. There's no independent jiva. The jiva is mitya. There's no independent jiva there. Right? The only jiva, the jiva is the Atma. But the Atma is not the jiva. When we say jiva, what does it mean? Is that you take yourself to be a limited being? It means there's an identification with upadi, with the body, mind, sense organs. Why is that the ahankara? Why is that identification there? Because of ajnanam, because of self-ignorance. If self-ignorance is not there, then that identification won't be there. So the identification is a product of self-ignorance.
Yeah, but the thing is, it seems then that basically Ishvara is creating ignorance.
No, not exactly, no. It actually looked like this. This is where this avarna vikshepa becomes useful. When we say that the maya, so we've got Brahman and maya. Maya is the natural to Brahman. And if we don't have any place to put maya, we just account for it because here it is. Right? So now, if we say, the Shruti says, you have Brahman, but this maya projects as the entire creation. That's what we call Ishvara. Ishvara is Brahman with Maya. Okay, so Brahman manifests with the creation, with the Maya Upadi, manifests as this creation. We call it an infinite manifestation of knowledge. Manifestation of infinite knowledge. That's the Maya Upadi. Now, so for Ishvara, we'll say that the Maya has only one of the ajnanam, or maya, has only one quality, which is vikshepa. Maya projects. But from the standpoint of the jiva, there's two qualities, which we call avarna and vikshepa. The maya covers, it projects and it covers. It's that covering that we call ajnanam. From the standpoint of Ishvara, from the whole, the maya only has vikshepa, only projection. But that projection is the avarna for the jiva. That avarna is what we call ajnanam. Okay. So the ajnanam is only from the standpoint of the jiva, because the jiva has what we call upajnaha, limited knowledge. Limited knowledge means the upadi, right? The mind is limited. And so that mind and sense organs. So the jiva has limited knowledge. And that means that the maya is acting as a covering, right? For the Atma. but not from the standpoint of Ishvara, because from the standpoint of Ishvara, the whole Maya Upadhi projects, so there's no limitation anywhere, there's no Ajnana, because the whole, it's a manifestation of the whole. That's why we use we like to use the example of either dream or better, sometimes even imagination, like when I say, imagine a meadow with people walking in it. Right, if you imagine a meadow, there's people and animals walking, there's trees and sky, and can be raining, all kinds of things can be happening in this, your imagination. From your standpoint, there's vikshepa. You have projected, using the Maya Upadhi, you project the manifestation. And that manifestation is total knowledge, your total knowledge, say. In other words, if you just look at the projection as total, the total knowledge that you're experiencing, you're not bound by any ajnanam, right? But that same vikshepa projection of the Maya Upadhi that comes from you, so you're Ishvara of that imagination. All the creatures that are part and parcel of the imagination, that same what is vikshepa for you is avarna for them. It causes avarna, it causes covering. Right, so every single part of that imagination is limited, like every creature, every animal, every tree is limited. And so the vikshepa is acts as a covering now. Mm-hmm. Right?
So deha, mabuddhi, nejana, that's mm-hmm. a product of maya, really. Right? It's an effect of maya.
Well, we would say, look at the we would say it exists within maya. Because all duality and everything, every phenomenon that is part of Ishvara. Everything that comes and goes, every experience, right? That's all part of Ishvara. So there is nothing within duality that's not part of Ishvara. Even any experience of the jiva, because there's nothing about the jiva that's not part of Ishvara. So what's the difference between, you have to see, what is adhishtana and what is mitya? What is satyam, what is mitya? What is satyam? You know, is it going to be coming and going? It's not a thought, it's not the removal, it's not ajnanam, and it's not the removal of ajnanam. It's not bondage, it's not liberation. It's not an Upanishad. It's not the teaching of the Upanishad. It's what the Upanishad is teaching about. Right? But the Upanishad itself exists within duality. The teaching exists within duality. The bondage and liberation within duality. Duality. The teaching tetvamasi within duality. The teaching aham brahmasmi within duality. But these mahavakyas, this teaching, has a lakshartha, means it is pointing to. The teaching which is in mitya, in maya, is pointing to the adhishtana of maya, which is not away from the maya. And you are that adhishtana. And so the maya is being taught, the maya upadhi is being taught that it is the maya upadhi. And what is the maya upadhi and what is the adhishtana? And because the adhishtana is self-evident as me, the mind can make that differentiation between the shining, self-evident me and its own mityatva.
And so would you call that non-dual? Is that what you're...
Yeah, this is non-dual.
We're using the duality to see the non-dual.
Yeah, I should be able to say, when I see, when you understand satyam mitya in reference to this creation, this is advaita right here. The subject is the object. Hmm. Right? The truth of the subject is the object. This is advaita. Even though there are many names and forms, the satyam is only one. The adhishtana is only one. Like when we have this bas relief sculpture, say made out of clay, some intricate scene is sculpted into a block of clay. The advaita is the clay. Right? Even though there's an intricate scene going on, it's been sculpted into the clay. But there's only one thing there, and that's clay. You know?
Pujaswami, in that first transcript of the first dialogue, he talks about this a bit when he talks about the vritti, when it's reflecting its own self-nature, it's still a vritti, right? But it's a non-dual vritti because it's just reflecting its own self-nature.
What's happening there is the vritti, normally the vritti is taking on some sort of nama-rupa, some sort of name form, either in a subtle form or physical. So the vritti is existing, that is filled with some sort of dual image of some sort or another. In a khandakara vritti, mm-hmm. right, the focus of the vritti itself is on the awareness that's illumining the vritti, rather than being the focus of the vritti being on some names and forms. When that happens, it's not that the vritti is now lighting up the consciousness. It's not lighting up the consciousness. The consciousness of myself, which is myself, is still lighting up the vritti, but now the vritti doesn't have any content other than consciousness, so that the superimposition that normally takes place isn't taking place. Right? Because normally, if you have a thought like, say, now, through my eyes, I'm seeing that painting. I'm seeing this room, but I'm focusing on the painting. Now I say, oh, look, that painting is known, that painting exists. So now what has happened is consciousness and existence, which is existence, has been superimposed on the painting. I'm giving the painting, through my ajnanam, the existence and consciousness. I'm saying that the existence and consciousness belongs to that painting. It is known, and it is. It exists. So now say, what I have to do now, in order to break this superimposition, all right, I'm going to pull my vritti. I'm not going to let my vrittis go out through my sense organs, first of all. I'm pulling them back. And not only that, I'm not going to let the vritti be thinking about this and that and the other thing. I'm going to just quieten this vritti down. I'm going to make this, I'm going to do some japa or something, some pranayama. Make this vritti become silent. Okay, so now I'm getting rid of all of the nama rupas, all of the names and forms that were going on in this vritti. Now that becomes quite, now I just have the silent vritti. Now I'm going to turn this vritti toward the consciousness that's illumining it. Right? Just so, because I don't want to be illumining silence, let the vritti also just totally go into its own adhishtana, into its own being. So now what happens? Now the awareness that has been illumining the vritti all along, whether the vritti is of the painting or of the room or of a thought or an imagination in my mind, now the mind has just become quiet and focused on the content, the being itself that's the very self of the vritti, that is illumining the vritti. Then what do I realize? That the sat-chit of the vritti, right, is actually its own being. It does not belong to anything. It is the very being which everything enjoys. And when everything is withdrawn, it is just there alone by itself.
So when you clearly see that, then?
Then when the world is back, my mind is active, my sense organs are working, I now recognize, oh, the sat-chit that I thought belonged independently to all of these things is actually the adhishtana, the very being which all of these things enjoy when they're there, and when they're not there, it is just there. The adhishtana is free. It's not dependent. I am free. I'm not dependent on the presence or absence of these things.
And in that context, Ishvara is, when all of that's resolved, Ishvara is resolved as well? I mean, if there's no duality, then there's no Ishvara, right?
Well, because Maya is beginningless, there's no beginning for Maya, and Brahman is timeless, there's never not Ishvara. Brahman is Ishvara, Ishvara is Brahman. But the Brahman, Ishvara doesn't have to be manifest, you know? In other words, the creation can be manifest or not manifest. It doesn't mean that the Maya isn't there, it's just the manifestation isn't there. That's why the Shastra says that they view the creation, the Upanishad says that creation is cyclical, means it projects, manifest knowledge resolves, manifest knowledge resolves. That means the Maya is beginningless, it's there, you know, but it's not always manifest. But being nitya, it has no substance of its own.
Well, when we absorb like that, it's almost, it's something very much like that cycle, then. There is no object, there's only subject.
That's right. Like, say from the standpoint of the jiva, means the jiva upadhi, if you withdraw your mind, right, at that time, your only experience, even though the mind is what we say is an atisukshma vritti, it's just resolved, it's not non-existent, but it's very, very subtle, right? There's no experience of duality, just my being. Then when the mind, you know, comes out of that condition, then there's the experience of duality. So that's like what we call nirvikalpa samadhi.
Like a mini pralaya or something.
Yeah, it is. It yeah, is. It's like the jiva. The jiva gets to experience in little, in a limited way, what Ishwar experiences in a total way. Mm. So it's like a mini, we call it nirvikalpa samadhi. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the mini pralaya. Yeah.
But we're talking actuality. I mean, this is not just words.
Mm-hmm. It's words that are talking about what the reality is.
You know what is kind of strange is, like, once you see that, and you were also saying that, like, once you see it, it's not anymore what you thought it was or something. It's like, let's say the snake rope phenomenon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that snake rope experience is literally a more penetrating experience. Even though you can say, for example, I might realize, okay, the rope is not the snake, right? But then the next day I walk along the road, even though I know the rope is not the snake, I might see a rope again and I still think for a moment the snake is a rope.
Well,
so there's a certain kind of, where's the consistency in the experience of what you're pointing at, actually, when is it really kicking in? You know what I mean? It's like, when is it really happening? How much cultivation of awareness does it take that it actually flips and that you don't go back into the identification more than you are actually staying in the, let's call it, Ishvara awareness.
That's why we're talking in Panchadashi about this viparita bhavana. Because the mind is so habituated to taking the self as the body, you know, and for dealing with this, thinking this world is real. It's like that type of behavior continues to come, and that's why you bring the mind back based upon your knowledge, because it's habituated to thinking this way and feeling this way. And then as it does now, but once you gain knowledge, I mean really as you gain clarity, then the mind's a habitual behavior because of lifetimes, and the whole universe supports that, those conclusions. But now that habitual behavior is happening in the light of your knowledge, the buddhi that knows. Mm-hmm. And so then the buddhi then pulls it back.
Mm-hmm.
And it just keeps doing that as it needs to.
It gets boring at times, you know, to just pulling back. I mean, there's a certain, it's kind of interesting and it's kind of a wonderful transformation process and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something also that is just like, it's just so much maya, you know, to kind of go back into this identification over and over, even though
you
see
it. Well, you don't do it on purpose. It does
right.
It to you.
Right. I know.
Yeah.
You've been had.
Because of the samskaras, you know. All the vasanas are the samskaras. All of those tendencies are all there. But, you know, what the real crux of the problem is, I think, is this ananda, the superimposition of ananda on your of your wholeness, of your well-being on the creation. And that is just so entrenched and so, there's such a fine, organized network.
You keep looking there. You know, you keep looking to the world to
this, I need this to make me happy.
Yeah.
You know? And it's so subtle.
And it works.
And it,
yeah.
Ice cream, cookies.
Yeah. It works only for a moment, but it does work. Yeah. That's
vicious.
Right. You know, so that's where, that's what we mean by vairagya. You know, this viveka vairagya. The vairagya is something that takes, grows naturally out of the viveka. And viveka with this knowledge keeps increasing as the viveka increases and becomes more real. When you start as a mamuksha, only one side of the viveka is known, the discrimination, and that is all of this changes. Nothing can provide me with anything stable. The mamuksha has recognized that. But the other side of it, what is nityam? Nitya anitya vastu viveka. What is nitya? What is real? What is free from time? That part is unknown. Right? And so the viveka has to become whole, where the anitya, the temporal, is known as well as the nitya, what is real. The atma is known. Now, as that happens, the vairagya becomes something which is real. In the sense, the dispassion is no longer just sour grapes. None of these things will make me happy, and so I don't want them. You know, all of these things are bound by time, and so they're not going to do it. That's the mumukshu's vairagya, right? But that vairagya resolves into ananda. The vairagya, the dispassion, fulfills itself in the ananda. That, you know, I don't, it's not that I don't want this because it won't make me happy. I don't need this because I am full. When you're happy, you don't say, oh, where's some happiness? When you're whole, you don't search for wholeness. So the vairagya resolves in your own wholeness. And that process, that's the process that that we have to be patient for that, because what is most dear to me is my wholeness. It's not my existence. People kill themselves because they exist and they don't want to exist because they feel so much pain. So existence is not what we love about ourselves. It's that the existence itself is ananda. If I superimpose the existence on something that's painful, no. It's the recognition of the ananda of myself that frees the mind from its need for this. Right? And so if I am full, then I can allow Ishwar to be. But that full, that there's a transition as my mind pulls away from the, it lets go of the tentacle, it has its tentacles out here. I kind of need it to be like this to be happy, and this is very refined.
So do we have a little roadmap for that? I mean,
this teaching is the roadmap. You know, it's a process. That's bringing, it's bringing myself, when I bring my mind back, it shouldn't just be half of the story. Half of the story would be on pull my mind back, because none of this will make me happy. None of this is myself. This is all not real. It's pulling back to the source of, to what is real, to the ananda. Pulling my mind back to the wholeness which is timeless, the well-being which is timeless, to the fact that as I relax my mind, the mind itself reflects the ananda of myself. There's two things here. My own being is ananda. That ananda is present no matter what the vritti, whether I have a sukha or dukkha vritti, it doesn't matter. Happy vritti, sad, it doesn't matter. The wholeness of my being is there, informing, filling the vritti, is the adhishtana of the vritti. That is there. So that timeless wholeness needs to be recognized. And I pull myself back just recognizing that I, in fact, am whole and complete as I am. I don't need all of these things. That's one thing. Second thing is that this mind that is so capable of enjoying extreme pain as well as pleasure, there's a whole gamut of emotions that this mind is capable of giving me. What causes the extreme pain, the extremely painful emotions, is the agitation in the mind that is caused by, I need this and I'm not getting it. That's what, on one form or another, that's what causes the tension in the mind. That is what we call pain in all of its variety of forms. When the mind is relaxed, that is what gives the mind innumerable experiences, variegated experiences of pleasure. It's relaxed a little more in this way. It's this kind of pleasure we call it. It's relaxed in this way. We call it this kind of, we have this name, compassion, joy, love, good cheer, whatever. It's all, these are all just different words that we use to label the conditions that are produced by a relaxed mind. A relaxed mind is a mind that is not feeling dependent on something. To be happy. Things are fine as the way they are. Now, that can be given to you by samsara just for this moment. Things are fine the way they are. You just enjoy it for the moment that it lasts. But for a jnani, things are fine the way they are because I am the source of the ananda and my mind is never away from me. And so the mind gains a natural, it naturally relaxes as it recognizes that. And then, so as that becomes more and more clear, the mind doesn't want to get tangled out here in samsara because it just is too painful. It's so much easier just to stay home, you know, and enjoy, and let the mind enjoy the ananda from its own source. And from that position of wholeness, then engage in the world and enjoy Ishvara. This is what Ishvara is. That's right, in the meditation I was talking about this in a different way, but I was talking about sukha and dukkha, punya and papa, pleasure and pain, all of it. All of these experiences are part of Ishvara. Right? The Atma is the Adhishtana, the self of all of that. And so when you've taken this physical, by your prarabdha karma, you've taken this body. This body and this life, it's not just this body, it's this life. It goes from birth to death. This life is going to be full of the results of punya and papa, manifestations of punya and papa, pleasure and pain. And so the papas will not be pleasurable. They're not meant to be. And so the papas are manifesting, the punyas are manifesting. The papa's manifesting, you feel pain. Punya's manifest, you feel pleasure. Because pleasurable situation, painful situation. Then how, as a jnani, how am I toward this manifestation in punya and papa? Well, one thing, we'll see this in the Panchadashina in the next few verses. The jnani says, this is exactly what Vidyaranya says, the jnani approaches this prarabdha with courage. That's what he says, daryam. Daryam. He approaches this prarabdha with courage because he or she knows it's going to be over soon. Right? And that the truth of it, this prarabdha will run itself out by its very nature. It's a combination of punya and papa. We have to accommodate it. It will come to an end. I am my being. I am free from all of this. But this prarabdha has to run itself out and I will be the recipient of the experiences it provides for me. And some will be pleasurable, some painful. That's how it is. Mm-hmm. And so for the jnani, that kind of accepts that Ishvara Om. And then does not build up a huge nest of pain around it, in terms of my own, all of my reactions, and why me, and how could this happen, and my life is screwed. All of these things, right? That doesn't happen, so punya papa, this is the prarabdha, this is Ishwara, just letting it be.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that life is not, it's not swargaloka. It's not going to be just one thing. It'll be a lot of different things. And not all of them are meant to make you happy. And so that gives a certain objectivity to the life and a certain acceptance. And then you engage, accepting it, you engage in it. Try to make it better. You know? But
try,
that'll
try to make it.
Yeah.
Like,
you engage. Say you engage in a, you, this is your power, but you accept it. Then you do, you try to make it better. What does that mean? You try to alleviate whatever pain is there in the best way that you can for yourself and others.
Kind of live a dharmic life, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you do your best. Yeah. There, I mean, that kind of decomplicates things. You know, it just unwinds a lot of the pressure. For Ajnani, it isn't like that. Because here I am a limited person in this world trying to get as much happiness out of it as I can. And I'm the karta, I'm the bhokta, I'm the doer in an inert world, basically. And I have to carve my happiness out of it, and I have to get rid of the papa and try to get rid of the bad things and get as much pleasurable things as I can. And it's an endless problem, you know. It's not to say that for jnani or ajnani, you know, I mean, we can appreciate the happy moments and the pleasurable moments, but we have a different way of accommodating the sorrowful moments.
But then why is it a problem?
It isn't.
Ah, okay.
That's what makes it not a problem. Because I'm not building a nest over it.
Okay.
I'm not building a whole network of my own projections and pain to make it into something bigger than what it is. You know, like you can have a sorrowful situation and the sorrow that you experience is part of that situation. That's what it is. But then there's so much we can do to make that into something excruciating. But much more than the sorrow that we're experiencing, or the sadness that is brought to us by the situation.
So the sorrow and the sadness, it's...
There's sorrow and sadness. There's all kinds of emotions that are generated by the situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can accept those as being part of the situation without myself making my antakarna, my mind, turning it into a knot of agony.
Making it worse?
Around the sadness of the situation. There are sad situations in life. There are hard situations, hurtful situations. They're all there. So the thing is, do you think that they're not supposed to be there? Do you think that we're supposed to be in, not have any of these? Well,
that's magical.
I'm sorry.
No, but that kind of thinking is kind of magic. It's a kind of a magical wish, and just.
It's not helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So, could you say then, if you subjectify a situation?
Subjectify.
Right, because if I objectify, then there's this opposite, or there's a separation experience, and the duality gets reinforced. But now, let's say I have a problem with you, and I start to subjectify that by actually looking at Ishvara in the moment of experiencing the conflict, then it's kind of like taking out the juice out of the identification process.
Yeah, you're using subjectify, which is
in a different context,
yeah.
But it's kind of interesting.
It's interesting, yeah. But that's right. That's what it's seeing. The whole thing is Ishwara. That includes,
mm-hmm.
in that scene of Ishwara, every part of you
mm-hmm.
is included,
mm-hmm.
also. So you're not, the subject and the object are equally included.
Right.
Subject object, right? Are equally mm-hmm. included in that. And also, Swami has done so many meditations now. I have a lot of them online. Of just that, recognizing the complexity of the cause-effect relationships that have gone in to creating a situation that you find yourself in now. Mm-hmm. There's cause-effect from every one of the players, mm-hmm. you know. And so it really is helpful to sometimes objectify the whole situation and then extend it out, and you see the network, mm-hmm. Ishwara's order, Swamiji will call it Ishwara's order, that's in play there. You know, and that Ishwara's order has actually produced this particular karma pola, which includes the emotion. That the emotion itself is part of the karma pola.
It's an object.
Yeah. You just see the whole thing, including the feelings, the emotions, the intrigue, everything that's gone into that given situation. You objectify it and take it back, cause, effect, in all of these different directions. And then, om. Yeah. Well,
thank you. Great question.